In the first hour today, we'll be talking about Colombia, a country that has been ravaged by civil war now for decades. Political violence connected with, sometimes with and sometimes not, the drugs trade has made Colombia now one of the most dangerous places in the world. The murder rate now is something like 30,000 a year, 75 political assassinations per week, 10 kidnappings a day. In this part of the show, we'll be trying to get a better understanding of Colombia and what has happened there over recent decades by focusing on one chapter in this long story, and that is a period beginning in the mid-1980s when there was an attempt by the main, what is now the country's largest guerrilla group, the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, an effort by the FARC to organize a political party. It was ultimately, I think we have to say, ultimately not successful. And we'll be talking about why in this part of Focus on 580 with Stephen Dudley. For 5 years, he filed regular dispatches from Colombia for both the Washington Post and also National Public Radio. He has written for other publications, including The Economist, The Washington Post Magazine, The American Prospect, Columbia Journalism Review, The Nation, Indies Times, and The Progressive. He now makes his home in Miami, and he writes for Miami New Times. He's authored a book that's out recently. It's titled Walking Ghosts: Murder and Guerrilla Politics in Colombia. Routledge is the publisher. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Dudley, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
No problem.
We appreciate
Thanks for having me.
Let me start out. I'm just curious, and I'm sure people would be interested to hear a little bit about how it is that you became interested in Colombia and its politics.
Well, it was a long process, you might say. But when I was a kid, actually, many of my brothers and sisters traveled down to Latin America. My brother spent some time in Nicaragua. My sister spent some time in Haiti. And through that, I became, you know, slowly interested, I guess, if you will, in Latin American politics. Then in college, I studied some. I went to Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and studied quite a bit about Latin America, and was particularly interested in political violence. I became very curious as to how things sort of evolved in almost a systematic way, in which, you know, certain political parties, or in many cases militaries, would attempt to eliminate political dissidents in different countries in Latin America. The first case I focused on was Guatemala, and I looked very closely at the Guatemalan military there, and eventually became caught up in the whole question of Colombia. Colombia was much more complicated than many of the countries that you find in Central America, just because there are so many interests involved. As you pointed out in your introduction, you've got everything from land interests to drug trafficking interests to governmental interests, and then political parties enmeshed in this conflict. And almost because of that complexity, I became really, really entrapped in Colombia. I like to say Colombia is a bit of a maze, and once you're stuck inside of it, it's very hard to get out of it.
To try to give people, and whenever we do something like this, I think it's important to try to give people some background and some context. So maybe I would ask you to go back a little bit to the period before the FARC existed, from the turn of the century, the turn of the last century, up until the mid-1960s, there was a lot of political violence in Colombia, and a lot of people, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people were killed. One period maybe you might highlight as a way of, again, sort of establishing some context is this period that in Colombia that's called La Violencia, the violence, say from 48 to 64, where there was fighting, bloody fighting between both conservatives and what are called conservatives and liberals in the country, between people who were interested in representing the interests of the large landowners and those people who were interested in peasant farmers. And also there was at this time an increase in guerrilla activity. There was a small communist party going on that was almost sort of a side issue to the fighting that was going on between the conservatives and the liberals in the country. Can you kind of talk about what was happening during this time?
Well, as you said, I mean, a lot of, you know, and not just Colombia, but a lot of Latin America's woes begin with the idea of land. You know, you have this, in many cases, you have, you know, large landowners controlling most of the land and a lot of smaller landowners trying to eke out a living on smaller plots of land. And that's essentially what happened in Colombia, and what came to a head and what became known as La Violencia really began as a struggle between these smaller landowners and these larger landowners. The larger landowners attempting to sort of integrate themselves in what was becoming what is modern-day capitalist structure. I mean, they were essentially trying to expand their coffee plantations in order to compete on an international level. And in their efforts to expand their own plantations, they ran into resistance from the smaller landowners. What emerged was this incredible sort of what's been called the spontaneous combustion of violence. Initially, this violence was along party lines. Colombia has been run by two parties since it came to be about 150, 175 years ago, and these parties are the conservatives and the liberals. And these two parties began to duke it out, if you will. And over time, this spontaneous combustion of violence turned into a violent struggle between all different facets of society. I mean, it became a place where people were settling personal vendettas, where different political parties, not just the liberals and the conservatives, were fighting it out with neighbors of all stripes, and it began to sort of evolve into this incredible violent structure, if you will. I mean, it became a place where all disputes were settled by violence, and an incredible displays of violent acts against one another became commonplace. Things that are just absolutely gruesome to us. I'll just cite one example: this idea of what was known as a necktie, whereby you actually pulled you killed your enemy, and then you pulled their tongue out and sort of wrapped it and put it in front of their chest in the form of a necktie. And there are many other just bewildering efforts at sort of debasing the enemy. And this left an indelible mark on Colombia and Colombian politics. The way in which people expressed their anger was through violence. The way in which people sort of settled their disputes was through violence. And the way in which they destroyed their enemy was by debasing them at the most base levels. And this really set the stage for what we know today as sort of a Colombian civil war.
I guess it also at this time that there was one of the various parties that was involved in all this fighting was a relatively small communist party that organized to try to provide some security for itself and its members in the countryside, and then also was involved more politically in the cities. And this was something that drew the attention of the United States and got the United States involved. This was the Cold War, after all, in aiding the government in an effort against the communists. Why the communists? It wasn't a particularly big party, and they weren't claiming particularly big areas of territory. Why was it that it became such a target for the government?
Well, I think it's important to note exactly what you noted, which was the context in which this whole thing was occurring. The Communist Party was very small, and to a certain extent represented very small interests. And they did represent these interests of these small landowners, and they found themselves fighting against larger interests, larger landowners, larger political parties, more organized political parties, and political parties that had currency within the government. So they would send pieces of the government, in some cases the police, in some cases the army, to really try and thwart the efforts of the Communist Party. The small Communist Party, in order to protect itself, began to use what they called self-defense groups. These were essentially able-bodied men or boys or even women in some cases that would actually set up sort of security rings around areas that the Communists controlled. And when the enemy was approaching, they would blow bugles and they would send off signals in some way to show that the enemy was approaching, and so that then they could organize their defense. Oftentimes they were successful in thwarting the attacks. Oftentimes they were unsuccessful. And over time, this sort of developed into a strategy whereby the Communists would protect their followers from attacks. And it became sort of entrenched, this idea that they needed to be armed in some way to protect themselves. Of course, if you are armed, then you are giving the enemy justification to continue to assault you. And so it became almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. So not only do you have this idea of the Cold War going on, but you have these armed groups who become more and more armed because they are being attacked, and who are fighting for, you know, what the government at this time, and certainly the United States government at this time, thought to be sort of, warped principles, in this case Marxism. And so the attacks became more and more. Eventually, they launch, and the government, with the aid of the United States government, launches an all-out fight against these very small communist enclaves. This provides the sort of backdrop under which the Communist Party decides to form what we now know as the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, which today continues to fight against the government. So this is the context in which the FARC is created.
Let me just quickly introduce again our guest. We're talking with Stephen Dudley. He's filed regular reports from Colombia over a period of 5 years for both the Washington Post and also National Public Radio. He's written for a number of other publications. He's got a book out now that's about Colombia that's titled Walking Ghosts, Murder and Guerrilla Politics in Colombia, and it's published by Routledge. And if you have questions, you can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Why did, given the fact that at least at the period that we're talking about, even as late as the mid-80s, FARC wasn't really all that big at that time. It's my understanding that some of the other insurgency groups that the government would have reason to be concerned about were bigger. So when this idea came along of trying to persuade FARC to form a political party and actually get involved in electoral politics and pull them perhaps out of the guerrilla business and into the political system, why was it that the government decided to make this pitch to the FARC?
Well, at the time, it was the early 1980s. There were several other guerrilla wars emerging in the region, in particular in Central America. You had, Nicaragua that had just gone through incredible upheaval, and the Sandinistas had just taken power in El Salvador and Guatemala. There were guerrilla wars going on, and the Colombians, who had been fighting, as we've already noted, since the 1940s and 1950s, were incredibly tired and weary of war, and so the government at the time sat down with all of the guerrilla groups, there were four, and said that we would like to discuss some way of resolving this. The largest guerrilla group at the time was the FARC. So the efforts of the Colombian government to speak to the FARC were part of this logic. They were part of the idea that the first thing we need to do is sit down with the guerrilla groups and decide how we're going to resolve this conflict. And the FARC was that group, and within that context, the FARC decided that the best way for them to sort of integrate themselves into the political process was by creating a political party. Therefore, the creation of this political party known as the Patriotic Union. And so you have sort of simultaneously peace process going on, but with a peace process, you always have to have the means by which any guerrilla group is then going to integrate themselves into the political process, henceforth the creation of this political party, the Patriotic Union.
Well, and also it seems that because the FARC had continued to have a strategy that said they would continue to use armed resistance in the countryside and a more political kind of strategy in the city, and they actually even had a name for it. They called it the combination strategy. That suggested that they weren't really, maybe they weren't completely committed to the idea of getting involved in electoral politics because they wouldn't give up and never really did give up, have not yet given up the idea of the armed struggle.
Well, this is the real crux of the matter, and this is really at the heart of the book. The heart of the book is trying to figure out whether or not the FARC really had an intention to enter into the political mainstream, or whether or not they were actually using this political party to further a larger goal, which is to topple the government. And herein lies the real difficulty in trying to figure out a place like Colombia. I mean, Colombia is about ambiguity. It's about this very large gray area in which people operate, in some cases, both in the legal sphere and the illegal sphere. When I say that, I mean, for example, you will have people who work in political parties who may in some way assist guerrilla groups. When I mean assist, we could be talking about everything from providing legal advice to actually providing some sort of, medical or food goods to the guerrillas. So there exists this gray area in which people operate that makes them, in some people's eyes, legitimate targets. And this was the real question with regard to this political party, the Patriotic Union. Were they in existence to help the FARC topple the government, or were they an end in themselves? Were they the means by which the FARC would enter into the political mainstream and give up their guns? The enemies of the political party in question, the Patriotic Union, believed that they were part of the larger strategy. They believed that they were just one facet of what you pointed out, the combination, or what they call the combination of all forms of struggle. And because they were simply one facet, they were legitimate targets. And over time, you saw this, the results of this vision. Because they were legitimate targets, these people, in many cases unarmed people, were assassinated. They were assassinated in massive numbers. By my calculations, at least 3,000 of them were assassinated. This is the reality of Colombia. I mean, the people who are dying in Colombia are more likely to be people who exist in this sort of gray area than the people who are sort of fighting on the front lines, if you will. The front lines being, where the guerrillas are fighting with the government, for instance. But the people who are actually dying are these people who are working in politics. And this is the real tragedy with regard to the story of the Patriotic Union.
Mm. Well, there were, I think you made the point, there were a lot of people who were committed to this idea of the Patriotic Union as a political party, and that they identified very strongly with that. For them, there was no hidden agenda or no second agenda. The agenda was to be involved in politics and as a legitimate political party. But as you say, what happened was because of the association with the Patriotic Union with the FARC, as far as a lot of people on the right were concerned, it doesn't matter what you called yourself, even people who were with the Patriotic Union were considered to be an extension of FARC. And they said, well, a guerrilla is a guerrilla. And so those people were targeted, and I imagine they were probably pretty easy targets.
Well, one of the things I track over time is this idea of people within the party beginning to understand that their role isn't necessarily what they thought it was. They initially believe that the Patriotic Union is an end in itself, is a means by which the guerrillas are going to hand in their guns. They are going to become, you know, part of the political mainstream. But what they begin to understand over time is that the FARC guerrillas really have no intention to ever hand over their guns, that they are merely pawns in a larger game. And this is a real tragedy for them, because the Patriotic Union wasn't just made up of people from the FARC, or, you know, people who were radical militants who believed in revolutionary strategy, including armed struggle. They were from all walks of life. I mean, they were housewives, they were unionists, they were from peasant syndicates, they were student organizers. And they came from all different parts of society, and with varying degrees of political radicalism. They didn't necessarily believe in armed struggle. They believed that the way to change things was through democracy. But what they ran into once they got involved, and what they began to understand over time, was that the people who had organized the party, in this case the FARC guerrillas, really didn't necessarily believe that democracy was the way to change things. And they found themselves sort of caught in the middle. And by being caught in the middle, they became the most sought after targets. They were the easiest targets, and they were the ones who died the most.
I have to also make the point here. I think that the government, for its part, had made a pitch to the FARC to come into politics, to organize this party. And there was some kind of promise that the government would try to provide some sort of protection against party members from attack. And it's something that the government really never followed through on.
Absolutely. I mean, from the beginning, the government made an agreement with the FARC guerrillas to establish this political party under all the laws that the Constitution afforded them. In other words, that they would work to protect all members of this political party, and that they would also work to integrate this political party into the political mainstream. But the result was really something completely different. The government, the military in this case, in particular members of the army, made a strategic alliance with elements that were outside of the government's purview, and they were called right-wing paramilitaries. And it was essentially this alliance between the army and right-wing paramilitaries that worked to systematically eliminate the Patriotic Union. They devised plans in different parts of the country to physically annihilate this, what they thought was an expression of guerrilla politics, of the FARC's politics, that they simply would not tolerate.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here to start us off in Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Hi. It seems to me that the government had a combination theory, too, actually, if you're talking about the FARC. And you were just talking about it. Basically, there were elements in the, as you say, there were elements in the FARC that were very unlikely to surrender weaponry, but there were also elements inside the government and inside the quasi-government, the paramilitaries, who were supported and have still been supported by the government, even though there is a campaign against some factions of them now in Colombia, that were looking at this as an opportunity to for people to step up so they could be mowed down.
I think you're absolutely right. One of the things I go through in detail in the book is this whole idea of the combination of all forms of struggle being used by all sides. Certainly the government, even dating back to the period that we talked about earlier, la violencia, or the violence, was using this combination of all forms of struggle. They had paramilitary groups, they used the police, they used the army in certain cases, all to further their ends. the difference between the way in which the traditional political parties, the conservatives and the liberals, used the combination of all forms of struggle, and the way in which the Communist Party used the combination of all forms of struggle, had a lot to do really with rhetoric. The Communist Party publicly and boldly stated over many, many years that they were using the combination of all forms of struggle, and that what was their armed wing was the FARC. I mean, this sort of bold public statement both gave them some sort of currency within the left, in particular left people who were sympathetic to this idea. So it also sort of bolstered them on the one side, but on the other side, it made them very vulnerable. So they wanted to use sort of both sides of the combination of all forms of struggle. On the one side, or what happened was they were sort of abused on both sides, if you will. On the one side, they were emboldened by this, and they gained supporters because of their, you know, their very brash statements. But on the other side, it made them vulnerable to attack.
Well, you've sort of talked about the U.S. role, and it's mainly as an anti-communist thing. And this has historical legacy, as you say. It goes back, I think, even to almost to the days of the La Violencia. There is a book called The Practice of Statecraft that has a whole chapter on CIA involvement in Colombia. And I think one of the people that went on to be a big mover and shaker in pre-war Vietnam, I forget his name at this point, was involved prior to that experience. He was involved in Colombia. And we have now a lot of focus on, and this is a bit of a digression from your book, but I assume you're watching Colombia closely. So we have this focus on private military contractors, and these are used very widely by the U.S. The people that are doing the fumigation in Colombia are mainly American hired folks. It was used by the Clinton administration to keep there was a restriction on the number of Americans allowed into the field of battle, as it were, into Colombia, and they were using these private military contractors to go over that figure, and this is a long-standing tradition. So it seems to me one has to look to the large neighbor to the north when one talks about Colombia politics, even as far back as the 50s.
I mean, absolutely. The practice of using sort of extra governmental forces, you know, you can date it back many, many years, including, you know, the training of different foreign forces by the United States, even going back to the Philippines, going back to Vietnam, and then continuing on through many, many countries in Latin America, whereby the United States essentially said that the best way in which to control populations is to have these sort of extra-governmental forces. And when I say extra-governmental forces, I'm mainly referring to what we commonly call paramilitaries. You know, paramilitary has a very negative connotation, but paramilitary essentially just means extra-military force. And the United States employed this strategy across the globe, and they have used it in El Salvador. They have used it in Guatemala. They helped the Peruvian government set up a system of extra governmental forces, and in Colombia, of course. I mean, it was a United States strategy, and many United States trained military personnel that implemented this strategy of using these extra governmental forces. And you can see it, you know, in Iraq as well. There's constant talk about the use of paramilitaries now, and what role the paramilitaries are going to play in sort of quelling the constant disturbances that you're already finding in Iraq.
Well, the figure I heard for Vietnam was 1 out of 100 were private contractors of some sort, though there's some argument about that, saying that it might be as high as 1 in 10, which it's probably is the case in Iraq. But that is a bit of a digression. But as you say, the U.S. was involved in setting up some of these civil patrols and fostering them, and now the legacy of that is the paramilitary force that the right-wing government is even having to rein in to some extent. Okay, thanks.
All right. Well, I think as the caller points out, it's hard to underestimate the impact on Colombia of U.S. interests Over the past 5 years, Colombia has received more than $3 billion in aid from the United States, most of that military, and that makes it the third largest recipient of U.S. aid after Israel and Egypt. And it seems, as far as the United States is concerned, that it's driven by concerns over illegal drugs. How, though, does that aid and the interest of the United States perpetuate the civil war? Or does it perpetuate the civil war?
Well, I mean, it's such a hard thing to track. But I mean, if you look at the beginnings of a lot of these struggles in Latin America, for instance, which is more of my focus, you can see that the United States saw it through the prism of sort of the Cold War. There are these communists on one side, and there are everybody else, and on the other, and because they kind of viewed it through this very narrow prism, they may have miscalculated the need for military action or the use of military action in many of these countries. And I would argue that was certainly the case in Colombia, whereby you had a very small number of communist party enclaves that were in existence in Colombia, and many of them seeking to establish better relations with the Colombian government, and I'm talking about the early 1960s, and the government simply thwarting those efforts and thwarting those efforts with the United States kind of supporting them. The United States training their military personnel. The United States sort of entering into the struggle over these countries, but always through this very narrow prism of the Cold War, and it led to extreme miscalculations, and in this case, a smattering of civilians trying to fight off a force of 10,000 Colombian troops in the early 1960s. You know, the mismatch is just staggering when you think about it in those terms. But the results that we can see today is that smattering of civilians that were fighting against the Colombian government at the time has now turned into a force of 20,000 men that threatens to destabilize the entire region. So it's hard to say, if A causes B or B causes C, but you can certainly see that the use of the United States forces to sort of thwart any sort of efforts in these countries to fight for their land or to fight for educational or health rights, and if they were in any way associated with communists' interests, then they were immediately thwarted and thwarted in a way that has led us in many cases to where we are today.
We're moving into our last 20 minutes. Maybe I should introduce again our guest, Stephen Dudley. He now lives in Miami and writes for Miami New Times. For 5 years, he filed regular dispatches from Colombia for Washington Post and National Public Radio. And he's also written for a number of other publications. Just to mention a few, The Economist, Washington Post Magazine, Columbia Journalism Review, The Nation. If you're interested in reading more about Colombia, you can look at his recent book. It's titled Walking Ghosts, Murder and Guerrilla Politics in Colombia. It's published by Routledge. The next caller here would be in Urbana, and it's line number two. Hello.
Hi, line two?
Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering about Manuel Marulanda, one of the founders and the heads of the FARC. He's been going at it pretty strong since 1947. Is there any kind of bio info on him? He seems to be kind of an elusive, mysterious guy.
Well, he started out, I think earlier in the program we were talking about this whole idea of larger landowners versus smaller landowners. He actually started out as kind of one of the smaller landowners, and he was part of a family of coffee growers, eventually started his own shop. He had a small shop and was carrying on with this small shop when this period of violence began, this great social upheaval that sort of really has laid the groundwork for everything that's going on in Colombia right now. And Marulanda himself was then a member of the Liberal Party, which is one of the two main parties in Colombia that has really run Colombia since it came into existence. But over time, what happened to Marulanda was Marulanda saw the interests of his political party being, in some cases, thwarted, but more often than not, subverted, and subverted by some of the Liberal Party leaders. So he became almost disaffected, if you will, by his relationship with the Liberal Party. And switched over to the Communist Party, and largely switched over to the Communist Party because he saw some of these men betraying some of the other men, and he saw them being kind of almost disorganized. He was very impressed at the time with the way the Communist Party was organized, vis-a-vis some of the other parties, and saw that they were able to do what I explained earlier, which was protect themselves and protect their followers, and because he was very that appealed to him. He joined the Communist Party. Eventually, he becomes, as we know today, a legendary, what they call pistolero, or like a sort of. He had this amazing ability to be able to find people, if you will, in his viewfinder. His nickname is Sure Shot, and he also had an amazing ability to sort of strategize. There are countless times when the Colombian media would declare that Manuel Sureshot Marulanda, the leader of the FARC guerrillas, has been killed in battle. There as many as a dozen times this has been reported, but still Marulanda managed to find his way out, and these sort of public cries for his death and even announcements that he had died became disavowed, and soon Marulanda began to take on a sort of mythic quality that really characterizes the FARC guerrillas today. I mean, the FARC guerrillas, more than anything else, are characterized by this toughness of a peasant farmer. It's not as much the idea of a strong Marxist ideologue like you might have found with some of the leaders of the rebellion and of the rebel movement in the 80s in Peru. It's much more this idea of this peasant farmer that is strong enough to withstand this mighty government and this constant assault of this mighty government and even the assaults of the United States government, someone who can withstand that. And that's what the FARC represents now, and it represents these peasant interests, and Marulanda really symbolizes that. At his 70 some odd years, he is still the leader of that movement.
Yeah, I noticed that in some of the newspaper articles I came across from the 60s and El Tiempo, they had mentioned what you just said, that he had been killed several times, and that was, we're talking 35, 40 years ago, and he's still around.
Yeah. There's a famous story of a general who took part in the peace process in the early 1980s. He was a retired army general who goes down and actually meets with Marulanda, the first time in his life. And here's a guy who's been fighting against Marulanda his whole life. He finally meets him, and the two of them sit down and he says to Marulanda, how was it that you got out of that trap that we set for you, way back in 1959? And Marulanda just sort of smiles and laughs and says, that was easy, and so there's this sort of, mythic quality of Marulanda that really it extends to all parts of Colombia. I mean, not just those who follow him, but also those who fought against him.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm wondering if you might be able to just highlight or talk a little bit about the power structure of the FARC at the top.
Well,
in terms
the
of
FARC
its organization,
is,
maybe.
Yeah, I mean, the organizational structure of the FARC is that they've broken it up into six what they call blocks. Each of the blocks is beholden to what's called the Secretariat, which is sort of the central command. And each of the blocks has a number of fronts or columns. And it's a fairly decentralized structure. Because Colombia is such a regionally diverse country, there are several mountain ranges that sort of split up the country, different terrains. It's a very large country. It's about three times the size of Iraq, for instance. You have this sort of a decentralized structure whereby a lot of the front activity or the column activity is independent of the central command. And the fronts themselves can even spawn new fronts. In fact, that's the way the structure is really set up, so that each individual front can spawn new fronts. And that's how they've been able to grow at such a tremendous rate, especially in the last few years, is that they've really expanded their reach. And as they expand their reach, they're able to take over more economically important areas. And some of those areas are drug trafficking areas, and they're able to gather more money, and then with more money they can spawn more fronts. And so just in the last 10 years, you've seen almost a doubling in size of the FARC.
Hmm. The FARC is now the biggest insurgent group that's battling with the government. It has, at least the figures that I've seen, has something around 20,000 members, but that's only 20,000 people out of a population of 44 million. And it seems that while there's this sort of stalemate going on, in a sense, between the FARC and the government. That is, the government can't completely stamp it out, but nor can the FARC topple the government, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be able to. Does anybody stand up and say that on either side, say, the way we've been going here just doesn't make any sense?
Well, I would say that the FARC would definitely not agree with what you said. I mean, the reason that that's very hard to deal with Colombia is that within the FARC, the FARC believes that time is on their side. They're not in as much of a hurry as many others are. They for instance, in the early 1980s, began to set up a plan for taking power, and in that plan, it was anywhere from 8 to 30 years. They weren't necessarily thinking that we need to take power tomorrow, and if we run into a stalemate, then we're simply going to say, well, this is a stalemate, maybe we should sit down and talk. On the contrary, for instance, now you've got a government in Colombia that's been very actively been very aggressive with regard to the guerrilla war, and what has the FARC done but simply sort of retreated into their jungle hideouts, and said, well, this is a government that's going to last 4 years, then they're going to be out, and we'll take on the next government. I mean, they've decided that time is on their side, which makes it very difficult for anyone to deal with them. They're not in a hurry, and they know what they want. What they want is power, and they're going to wait as long as it takes in order to get that power.
And they believe that the armed struggle event is going to get them where they want to go.
Yes, which is really also part of the story of the Patriotic Union. The FARC will take the story of the Patriotic Union, this political party that they created in the early 1980s, that was so savagely destroyed. Despite their own nefarious plans for this political party and their plans to use this political party as part of their own struggle to topple the government, they will cite the example of the Patriotic Union as an example to say that they will never hand over their guns, that they can never hand over their guns because if they hand over their guns, they will be assassinated like all the members of the Patriotic Union. And this makes it, again, very, very difficult for people to sit down and negotiate with them, because when you negotiate with them now, they will never hand over their guns. While they're negotiating, they won't hand over their guns. And if they have their guns, it will become, again, what I referred to earlier, almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. It gives their enemies justification to keep attacking them. And while they're being attacked, well, then that means they have to maintain their guns and, in some cases, expand their forces. So it's almost like this vicious circle that you find in Colombia, where it's very hard to break that circle.
Let's go on and talk with somebody else. Another Urbana caller here, I think, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I just want to make a comment that deals more with the history of the FARC and where they came from. From what I remember, the FARC sprout from the Communist Party, where they were called mamertos, which meant not to be to really be representing an opposition to the modus operandi of the country. And that's probably why the FARC is still playing just a game. They were not really a force that represented opposition during the some years back. There were more radical groups fighting that were wiped out, like the M19 and other groups. And so it's why I think what the comment is, the comment of one of you says that the ongoing situation doesn't make any sense. And they will wait forever and nothing will be resolved.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting that what you say about the whole idea of mamertos, which is essentially means that these guys were suckers, that they were looked upon very early in their experiences as being suckers, as being these the Communist Party was looked upon as seeking a way in which they could work actively with the government, no matter what the government said. Mm-hmm. So given that their reputation of really trying to work with the government, it's amazing then that they were so readily targeted, even in those early years, as we were talking about earlier, by the government itself. And it's really another, you know, long list in a list of tragedies which has led us to the modern-day circumstances, whereby, you know, you now have, you know, in contrast to this whole idea of mamertos or suckers, you know, the FARC is now looked upon, and the Communist Party is sort of latched onto this idea as well, as the only form of resistance left to the government,
right.
As opposed to their beginnings, where they were the sort of one part of the left that actively sought out their relationships with the government and to enhance those relationships.
Yes, I agree with you, and it's a very good analysis of what you are doing, and I like your description of the violence by saying it's a spontaneous combustion. It sounds very good. I like that definition of the violence in Colombia. Thank you, and I will hang up.
All right, well, thanks for the call. We'll try to get one more caller at least in the time we have remaining. I think this is also Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, I think there's, from what I understand, there's quite a lot more involvement with the drug trade amongst the paramilitaries than the FARC. The FARC would, like, tax them. In a way, the paramilitaries are far more interested in the whole narco-trafficking, protecting it and all that. But I wanted to ask you, what do you know about the involvement of the Israelis and the training of the paramilitaries in Israel? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, just very quickly, because I know we're running out of time, but the history of the paramilitaries has really lent itself to the relationship that the paramilitaries have today with drug trafficking. A lot of the money that the paramilitaries had from the beginnings came from drug traffickers. They were largely financed by drug traffickers. And even in the early 1980s and middle 80s, this money provided them with weapons and training. And some of this training did come from Israeli instructors, Israeli mercenaries, if you will. There were also British mercenaries that came and trained some paramilitaries in the 1980s. And today what you find is that the paramilitaries still maintain this very strong relationship with drug trafficking interests, and in some cases are major drug traffickers themselves. There have been several paramilitary leaders that have been indicted in recent years by the United States government for their direct involvement in shipping cocaine to the United States. So I would agree with you and say that the paramilitaries are much more enmeshed in the drug trafficking trade itself. Having said that, the FARC is a beneficiary, a major beneficiary of drug trafficking, of the drug trafficking enterprise itself. They operate in regions where drug is both cultivated and the drugs are processed, and in that process, they secure money for protection. You know what they call protection. They secure money for from really everything along the chain of events that go into transporting drugs to the United States, including protection and transportation mostly. But they are major beneficiaries. You know, upwards of hundreds of millions of dollars per year they probably secure from being close to and operating in these drug-producing areas.
And I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies for interrupting, but we're simply at the point where we're going to have to stop, and we'll have to leave it at that. For people who would like to read more, you look for the book we've mentioned. It's titled Walking Ghosts by our guest Stephen Dudley, who now writes for Miami New Times, also has reported for Washington Post and NPR about Columbia. Thanks very much, Mr. Dudley, for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.